You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Nestled, but hardly comfortably, between India, Pakistan, and China sits Kashmir. And currently 500,000 Indian soldiers have been occupying Kashmir, more than the number of foreign troops and mercenaries occupying Iraq and Afghanistan combined. And in August and September this year, hundreds of thousands of Kashmiri people have been massing in unprecedented nonviolent opposition to this Indian occupation. We're gifted this morning with the voice of Arundhati Roy, prize-winning novelist and renowned social justice activist. She has been in Kashmir, immersed in this popular uprising. This evening, in India time, we've reached Arundhati Roy at her home in New Delhi. Warm welcome, Arundhati, and thank you for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you, Mordecai.
Can you sketch the historical elements you consider essential for us in Canada if we are to just begin to understand the significance of the immediate realities in Kashmir?
Well, I think the main pointers are that Jammu and Kashmir used to be a princely state, you know, one of the many princely states that were asked to accede to either India or Pakistan at the time when India and Pakistan were partitioned in 1947, you know, just as the British left. And most princely states did, whereas Jammu and Kashmir, which was basically, the king was a Hindu king called Hari Singh, but he ruled over a largely Muslim population. He sort of prevaricated and he didn't decide what he wanted to do. There was a big movement within Kashmir at that time, a big movement for democracy and against the monarchy. And in 1947, when he didn't make up his mind, sort of tribal fighters from what had then become Pakistan came into Kashmir, you know, supposedly to liberate them, but it was quite a violent incursion. And Hari Singh fled from Srinagar to Jammu, which is the sort of Hindu-dominated area of the state, and he asked Nehru and Mountbatten to send in the Indian army, and they said that they couldn't send the army unless he would, you know, formally accede to India, which he did. But the condition was, the condition that Mountbatten and Nehru agreed to, and in fact suggested, was that there would be a plebiscite. You know, since Hari Singh in no way represented his people by then, there was a big popular movement against him. But ever since 1947, there has not been a plebiscite, and instead, you know, half of Kashmir or a part of Kashmir has been taken by Pakistan, and then Indian troops have been sort of massing in the Indian part of Kashmir. And of course, in the publicity and in the Indian imagination now, particularly by the right-wing Hindu groups, it's publicized as, you know, as though it's always been a part of India, which it hasn't been, you know. And now it's turned into a full-blown military occupation, even though the Indian government likes to say that it holds elections. But the point is that how can you hold elections when you have around the year, you know, more than 500,000 soldiers there? And since 1990, there was a sort of militant uprising, which was crushed, and you know, it led to between 68,000 to 80,000 deaths. Torture centers had sprung up everywhere. You know, thousands and hundreds of thousands tortured, injured, raped, and then of course this massive military domination meant that, you know, the incidence of carnage and mass killing and so on reduced, but so did liberty, you know. And so now a kind of normality was forced down Kashmiris, you know, through the barrel of a gun. And when that normality basically dissipated, which was about 2 months ago, over the issue of a Hindu shrine, where the government tried to sort of transfer some land in Kashmir to a shrine board, and Kashmiris saw this as a plan to sort of form Israeli type of settlements in Kashmir, so that the Indian state could sort of consolidate its rule. And this resulted in a massive popular uprising. So really, and even today, I mean, you know, even today, though there's been curfew and so on, there was huge protests. Yesterday, people were killed. And it's just, you know, completely out of control right now.
There are, as you say, 500,000 Indian military in Kashmir, and hundreds of thousands of Kashmiris in nonviolent rebellion. Can you give us a sense of what the face-off between those two opposing forces looks like in human terms?
Well, I was there when, you know, the uprising first began, and then I was there a couple of weeks ago, and I'm going back tomorrow. But basically, I've been on the streets, and, you know, I've been at the heart of quite a lot of resistance movements in India. But I've never seen anything like this, because this is based in, it's sort of irrigated by a memory of such extreme repression, so much torture. This whole generation has grown up, in a playground of torture centers and disappeared people. We talk about, you know, Pinochet and Chile and so on, but there are many more disappeared people in Kashmir. It's a macabre sort of situation, and so these 500,000 troops, even a few years ago, some of us were asking, why is it that when the army itself claims that there are only about 1,000 armed militants, why do you have 500,000 soldiers there? Is it to control the people? You know, are the people of Kashmir really the target of this massing of troops? And the militant movement was more or less crushed. And then suddenly there's been this unbelievable nonviolent uprising, where just by their sheer numbers, they took these army and security personnel by surprise, and the government didn't really know what to do. And I saw, you know, for the first time I'd ever seen the city of Srinagar just floating on a cloud of ecstasy, because you suddenly saw people who had been humiliated and slapped and searched at checkpoints and picked up in the middle of the night, suddenly reclaiming their cities, you know. And it was a pretty awesome sight. I saw young men who had in the past week perhaps been humiliated by these soldiers in the bunkers that dot the whole valley, now forming sort of human chains around these bunkers to prevent the crowds from actually harming the soldiers, you know. And of course, when the curfew was imposed, those same soldiers came out and once again fired and once again humiliated these people. But, it's very difficult I don't know if I can explain this to a Canadian audience, but it's very difficult for, some people, progressive people in India, to know how to deal with the situation, because, you know, the more repressive the Indian state has been, and it has actually gone after secular forces in Kashmir. When the first uprising began, the militant uprising. It was a secular movement which was decimated both by India and by Pakistan, and therefore people were pushed both by the repression and by a way of dealing with that repression into a sort of faith, you know. So you have this people that has grown up just pouring out its sorrow into its shrines and its mosques and, you know, looking to God for help. And so the movement now is certainly very faith-based, but it's easy for people to say, oh, they are Taliban, but they are not Taliban. It's in fact a cradle of syncretic Islam. You know, at the time when Indians and Pakistani, well, Hindus and Muslims were slaughtering each other in 1947, Kashmir was not that, you know. But now, I mean, in 1990, there was a terrible moment when, you know, this very small minority of Kashmiri Pandits, who are basically a small minority of Hindus, very powerful but very small, was attacked by the Islamic hardline fringe. And then the governor, who was at the time a very communal person, basically said that he couldn't protect them and arranged for a sort of exodus, which is now called an ethnic cleansing and so on. So this movement will be stigmatized by that. But at the same time, it's not a sort of Taliban-like uprising by any description, you know. But in India, progressives are caught between this publicity of, oh, this is a Muslim state, this is a Taliban movement, and those same people are fighting a very Taliban-like Hindu resurgence in India, you know. So they are intellectually stuck between what is portrayed as a Taliban Muslim and what is in reality very Taliban-like Hindu fundamentalists who have even come to power, who are openly slaughtering Muslims on the streets in India, who are openly talking about, you know, fascist ideologies, who are openly claiming that India should become a Hindu state. So it's a little confusing for people here exactly how to fight this.
From your perspective, what is the essential change that must be made that would reduce that chauvinist and fascistic danger?
Well, I think that, you know, the more whether it's in Iraq or whether it's in Kashmir or whether it's in Palestine, you know, I think that the more repressive your regime becomes, the more, you know, the more brutal the people who are going to fight it have to become. So it is sort of contracting on both sides, you know, and there isn't going to be any way out of it. If India is going to insist on dealing with this with military force and military might, what it's doing is to radicalize a whole generation of young Muslims who are going to be a threat not just in Kashmir but in India and in the rest of the world, you know. So it's a very dangerous thing that is being done there, and I don't think that you know, this publicity of this great spiritual democracy and so on can continue to hoodwink, it ought to continue to hoodwink the world, because right now it really is a very dangerous culture that is being cultivated in India, in the mass media, this obsession with nuclear weapons, this obsession with military might. You know, you have right-wing, hardline Indian intellectuals who are openly propagating that India should do in Kashmir what Putin did in Chechnya and so on. And this is a danger to the whole world, not just to India, you know. So I think that those of us who have come out and condemned American imperialism and who have condemned the occupation of Iraq and who have condemned what is going on in Palestine, who have condemned the occupation of Tibet, we also have to talk about this. We cannot look away from this.
I'm wondering, you mentioned the massive mobilization of people and that the armed resistance to the Indian occupation had earlier been crushed. In this massive mobilization, are there identifiable leaders, whether individuals or organizations, who are setting the course of this uprising, or is it without that kind of familiar claim to leadership?
Well, I mean, there are identifiable leaders, but, you know, they are actually being led by the people, because the sort of massive outpouring of anger on the streets is actually pushing the leaders to do what the people want, which is quite extraordinary to watch. Because one thing that has happened in Kashmir is that because of the armed movement and because of the military occupation, it's become very, very difficult for any leader who were to actually show real vision or real leadership would be eliminated or neutralized in some way, you know. So many people in Kashmir see the history of their leaders as having been a pretty treacherous one. And I don't know how to explain this, but there's so much, the whole valley has been awash in illegal money and weapons and intelligence agencies and spies and all that stuff. You know, so the leaders, actually cannot, right now at this moment, I don't think that the leaders can play the games that they have been used to playing, you know, and yet people need leaders. So there are leaders, but they are, they have their fingers on the pulse of what people are saying. And then you have the leaders from the mainstream political parties who are being propped up by India, you know, who participate in the elections and so on, and who are the only people who the Indian media really talks to and invites to its television studios and so on. But those people are not even able to make an appearance on the streets of Kashmir. They would be just chased away, you know. So they really have lost a lot of credibility. But, I don't want to, you know, Kashmir is an industry of all kinds of things. And, you know, it has a industry of NGOs and an industry of Kashmir experts and so on. And I really don't want to, I mean, the reason that I wrote recently is because for the first time I felt that you didn't have to interpret what people were saying. You didn't have to pretend that you really had some secret knowledge, because people were representing themselves, you know. So it was so obvious. It was like they were saying, okay, if you're not going to allow us to have a plebiscite, then we're going to come out onto the streets and represent ourselves. And that was why I felt, as an Indian, I felt, it was a moral obligation of a kind on my part to say, look, how can this be done in our names? You know, how can we be crushing people like this in the name of this great supposedly secular democracy? So it really was, when I was there on the streets watching that anger, I felt that somehow, even everything that is beautiful about India, and there are things beautiful about India, is just tainted by watching this behavior, you know. And and all the intellectuals that have been trotted out. You have a stable of, you know, liberal intellectuals who've come out saying the most outrageous things, you know, saying that, you know, Kashmir should only be allowed to secede if they can prove that genocide has been committed, or that human rights amounting to genocide have been committed, or that India has tried to change the demography of the region. I mean, who would they have accepted that argument when India was fighting for liberation from British rule? Or if you use that argument, then the British should be back here, because, I don't think that you can say that they were more cruel than the Indian government, the Indian state is being in Kashmir. Certainly, we were not. They didn't have a bunker and an AK-47 at every 30 meters, you know.
Well, on that note, both the exhilaration of what is happening with the people coming to speak in their own voice in Kashmir and your courage in being there as an Indian, we'll wish you safety in the midst of the dangers all around. And thank you again for speaking with us this morning.
Thank you, Mordecai.
I've been speaking with Arundhati Roy. And tomorrow, a new documentary film on Kashmir, made by an award-winning Indian director, Sanjay Kak, will be shown in Vancouver. The film is titled How We Celebrate Freedom. The showing begins at 3 p.m. It will take place at Langara College, which is 100 West 49th Avenue, and a discussion will follow.